And welcome to Manx Radio, where you're listening to our 2026 House of Keys General Election Candidate Interview Series. I'm our election producer, Amy Griffiths, and we're giving all those intending to stand the chance to take part in a 30-minute interview with us to find out who they are and why they're standing. Today, we're hearing from Rob Callister, who's standing in Onchan. He's been interviewed by Alex Brinley.
Today I'm talking to Rob Callister, who is seeking re-election in the constituency of Onchan, first elected to the House of Keys as an MHK in September 2016 and then re-elected in September 2021. Now, Rob, looking through your manifesto from 2021, it's big on platitudes, what you'd like others to do, but noticeably absent on actual direct pledges. What do you actually stand for?
Okay, well, let's go through that manifesto. If you take something as simple as the living wage, I've sat on the poverty committee, I've sat within DfE, I've pretty much promoted, you know, the introduction of the living wage, for example. And if you've got to remember when I first elected in 2016, the Isle of Man minimum wage was about £7. And here today, it's £12.86. So that's one thing that I've committed to. Work permits, for example. Massive. Back in 2016, in my manifesto there, I made a very firm commitment that I would support the Isle of Man's legislation around work permits. And you know, in around 2022, DfE tried to suspend them, and I lobbied hard to make sure that I fulfilled that election pledge. So there's lots of things in there that absolutely, I have to admit, when I looked through my 2021, there wasn't so many pledges. My 2026 one will have very clear outcome pledges, because my 2026 election is all about delivery over the next 5 years. It has to be about delivery.
I mean, going back to that manifesto you mentioned there, let's look at some of the detail. We'll start with economy. In your manifesto back in 2021, you said the government needed to restore confidence, drive growth and opportunity. And 5 years later, many businesses on the island complain about rising costs, labour shortages, government bureaucracy. Why should voters believe that the island economy is stronger today than it was when you made that promise last time?
Okay, well, let's just remember when I drafted that, we did not know that Ukraine was going to be invaded by Russia. Secondly, we did not know that we also have to remember that we were coming out of the midst of COVID-19. Okay. And secondly, we didn't know that we're going to have a significant cost of living crisis, or we were going to have massive inflation pressures. All of these have happened over the last 5 years. So at a time of writing it, absolutely right, that I still today support businesses. I still support, as one of the priorities going into the next election, that we create the right environment for small to medium businesses to succeed, especially, but also so listening to bigger businesses. And I think we have to listen to them, because as I've said just before, we've increased minimum wage from £7 all the way up to £12.86 today. And that has had a knock-on effect with businesses who are saying their costs have increased, their number of people they're seeing is the same, but the actual amount of spend has gone down. Now, if you want to talk about success of the economy, I'm also the chair of planning. I've been the chair of planning for a number of years now. Just down the road here, we see the Villiers site now up and running. We now see Lakeside up and running, and these things are creating jobs. They are creating a different environment, how the island will look. So I have been successful on helping the economy as the chair of planning, supporting affordable housing, supporting businesses and creating opportunities.
In terms of the outside interest there, you mentioned outside, not interest, but so much effect on the economy, like the war in Ukraine and things like this. These are things that we hear from politicians a lot, that it's not our fault, it's out of our hands. So why are these things in manifestos if they can't actually be, if they're so reliant on external factors that we can't control?
Well, it's called the unknown factors. You know yourself, when Russia went into Ukraine, you know, it had a massive impact on wheat, on other crops. And the problem is, we don't know. And I know, going into this election, I know, and I can foresee it already, that in the autumn and the winter period this year, going into next, we could have further increases in utility costs because the situation in Iran. The world is uncertain at the moment. As politicians, we have to navigate through it. And I'll just go straight back to 2021. I was the chair of Manx Utilities, and we had to get through that energy crisis, and we did it so much better than the UK. Okay, we end up increasing, you know, we saw the price of natural gas increasing by 8 or 9 times the normal price. As the chair, my thoughts was always for business, always for the domestic customers, and we spent tens of millions of pounds shielding domestic customers and shielding businesses over two very difficult winters. That is me supporting the economic businesses on our island.
But has that knocked it down the road? Well, those tens of millions of pounds that, as you say, you spent shielding customers at that point, are we now paying for that further down?
Yes, we are. I mean, don't get me wrong, government stepped in and paid a certain amount to Manx Utilities to ease some of the pressure. But yes, we are still paying the effect of that. But that was better than increasing the tariffs of 100% for Manx electricity, which is what was being proposed at the time. And if you go back to that point, as the chair, and I do thank the Chief Minister because he helped me with this, I managed to persuade the Council of Ministers to reduce that 100% increase in electricity tariffs, which would have had a significant impact on business and domestic customers. If people go and Google it, we reduced it to 70%, and we actually reduced that over two periods. It cost the organisation, I think, about £4 or 5 million, but it was the right decision to get our businesses through a very difficult period. That is leadership. That is somebody being aware of what's happening outside and how the decisions we make impact domestic customers and business customers. And I've never been afraid to take on roles that are really problematic, but trying to find the right solution for the people of this island.
Now, you mentioned before housing, so let's move on to that area. And in terms of your manifesto back in 2021, you warned that housing was becoming increasingly unaffordable, said housing must be accessible for all. House prices and rents have risen since then dramatically. I mean, has government and the parliament failed us when it comes to housing?
I think there has been, the inflation's had an impact on this because a lot of landlords have left the market. Yes, there was conversations around the landlord registration scheme, and that had a bit of a nervous impact on the landlords. But we've seen rents increase significantly. The next administration needs to sit down with landlords, find a solution to get more properties open to rental, try and drive down some of the costs. Because at the moment, everyone was saying, yes, we've had increases in our minimum wage and our living wage, but most of that is disappearing very quickly on weekly groceries. And it's disappearing on the amount of rent we pay. And these are the sort of problems the next government has to address very quickly.
But obviously you mentioned there you have a role in the chair of the planning committee. Yeah. You argued back in 2021 that affordable housing requirements on developments should rise from 25 to 40%. Did you actively pursue that policy in Tynwald? Because it hasn't happened.
No, it hasn't pursued in Tynwald, but I have pursued it, and I'm even more convinced now today that it has to change. So I actually changed my parameters. So as the chair of planning, I now believe, and I've said this so many times, I have raised questions on this, but I just couldn't get the further I wanted to. I want to be very clear. The next government needs to actually change the criteria for affordable housing and drop it down to 10% for brownfield sites, given the complexities around it. But what I'd like to see is for greenfield sites, for affordable housing to increase to 35%. That is one of my priorities, will be in my manifesto, and if I can get myself into the right position, I will drive this forward.
So you've abandoned the 40% that you had in your manifesto?
I think 35 is the right figure, and this is from based on now, you know, 2 or 3 years as the chair of planning, going to see sites. We know that it's easier to build in the greenfield site because you just scrape the ground, connect to the infrastructure is already there, and your house is built. Problem is getting our brownfield sites. I want to see our brownfield sites developed. Again, as chair of planning, I've not been afraid to make decisions with the support of my colleagues on that board to get our brownfield sites developed. And you can see it, the Villiers site there, Lakeside, done. You know, these are problematic sites which have had political sort of pressure applied, but I've dealt with them. So I'm not afraid to step forward and make those difficult decisions. But based on my experience now, 35% has to be affordable on greenfield sites, and I really want to push that through, 10% on brownfield sites.
And just to clarify then, in terms of that original increase to 40% that you put in your last manifesto, you didn't actively pursue that policy in Tynwald. Will you be doing that? Will you be bringing that to Tynwald in the next administration if you're re-elected?
Well, it's not a case of pursuing. There's different ways you can do it. You can put a motion down, you can raise questions. I have raised it. There wasn't enough appetite to pursue it. There's no point putting something, for example, in Tynwald and have a debate and it just doesn't go anywhere. You've got to be able to have colleagues behind you to support it. I genuinely believe if I'm in the right position, I would like to pursue this to hack this on, because I think we desperately need more affordable housing going into the next administration. But we need affordable housing options. So not just the first time buyer schemes, we need to go beyond that. And the same for social housing. We need more social housing, but I don't want to see new social housing estates. I want to see a mixed I love the Castletown model, where you had exactly the same size house for social housing, first-time buyers and open market. That is the plan. That's the vision I'd like to see developed in the future.
Now, the island population strategy is part of the island plan, effectively, over the last 5 years. It's relied heavily on inward migration. I mean, in your opinion, have we built the homes? Have we got GP capacity, school places, infrastructure needed to support that growth? What's your view on immigration to the island and the services that the incumbent population as well as any inward population requires?
Well, let's just go back to the work permits. I won't repeat what I've just said about I fought very hard in 2023 to stop the Department for Enterprise for suspending work permits, and we absolutely succeeded on that. It was the right thing to do, and I'll continue to fight to make sure jobs, Manx jobs, are protected, making sure jobs for the Isle of Man are there. In respect of immigration, the Isle of Man's always been a welcoming place. Absolutely, we are a welcoming place, and people who want to come to contribute to our society should be. I've never once supported this figure of 100,000. Let's have a population of 100,000 and let's create 5,000 jobs. What I've always said is let's create the environment and it would naturally happen. And I know from my own research, going back 60 years, the Isle of Man's population increases by around 450 to 500 people a year, give or take. So I know it doesn't take rocket science that we need around about 250 houses every year to be built. And in this last administration, we've only built 1,457 houses in the last 5 years. We do need to accelerate it, but we need to work with developers to make sure we're building the homes that we need for the future. And it's about creating that environment for people to come to work and to live here.
But that you've mentioned their homes, that's obviously a very important point. But my question was regarding the wider infrastructure and services, because they if you talk to people that are complaining about things, it's the state of the roads. They can't get a GP appointment. You can't get to the dentist. The Manx care situation and the general look of the island, it looks like it's not maintained.
OK, let me give you one of my priorities that will definitely be in my manifesto, because this really upsets me and I know it upsets a lot of people. So, for example, the Isle of Man collects around £14 million in road tax, okay? But we only spend £6 million. And some of that actually goes on the TT course instead of the road. So I want to actually see, very clear, if I'm in the right position to be able to drive this, I want to actually see road tax ring-fenced just for 5 years. And then work with local authorities to make submissions, and then we add a priority list, and we spend all £14 million that collected, every penny of road tax, fixing our roads for the next 5 years. That is something very tiny. It's, you know, out of a £1.4 billion budget, it's tiny. But you know, it'll make a massive difference to the look and the feel of our island. So that's something that will appear in my manifesto as a pledge.
And in terms of other services, I mean, this is where let's move on to health, because this is a topic that's on everybody's lips. In your manifesto 5 years ago, you said that elected members must ensure Manx care drives down waiting times as a priority. Now, waiting times remain one of the biggest concerns. You know, has Manx care delivered on the promise that you made to voters? And do you think Manx care is working?
Okay, no, I don't think Manx care is working. I think we have to look at that model. We're now spending over £404 million. I think there's something not quite right with what's going on with Manx care. Do I think they're trying their best? Yes, they are. But I think there has to be a change of the system. Just to go back to what you said in respect to my manifesto, let's be perfectly honest. I was the minister at the time in October 2022, and I actually moved a motion for £18.3 million to drive down waiting lists. That did have a significant effect, and I know a lot of constituents, you know, across the island were grateful to have those operations they desperately needed. We need to do more of that going into the next administration, but what we need to do is get better financial control over Manx care, and especially within the nobles, of actually improving the culture in there as well. And something has to change. Now, I've actually said I actually would look at the Manx utilities model of how that board is structured, because I've said quite openly that I think the chief executive of Manx Care is too exposed publicly, and I think there should be more political element of that. So I would go for a political chair, possibly a political vice chair, and that will take some of the pressure off the chief executive to deal with the day-to-day operations of getting a health service that we can be proud of.
In terms of having the benefit of hindsight, do you feel that politicians have been effectively hoodwinked by the St. Jonathan Michael's report. It's a failed experiment, and things were not that bad when it was the Department of Health.
No, I think we've got to look at this. One of the things that came out for the St. Jonathan Michael's report was the fact that it was difficult for a politician, and as you say, we are made up of all different walks of life. We can be a baker, a candlestick maker, etc. And then to go and ask somebody who earns £500,000 as a consultant to say, you must do this way, it just will never work. So what we actually did with the Manx Care model is to put people of equal profession to actually speak to these people and say their behaviour, their culture must change. Now, that hasn't worked in the last 5 years, and I still think we've still got some of the real core issues that we had back in 2020 still there within Nobles, and they have to change.
But listening to your answer there, yeah, effectively, we now give circa of a £400 million a year to Manx Care of taxpayers' money, and we've made that organisation arm's length or democratically unaccountable when a politician is not necessarily directly responsible. Is that right?
I don't think it was the right model. I think it needed to be. I think there has to be a political element on that, because that political element is the person who stands up in Tynwald in the House of Keys and answers those questions. And if, for example, as I was chair of Manx Utilities, or I'm the chair of planning, or you know, the chair of the Public Service Commission, if I need to, I have to answer questions, and I'm accountable on the floor to my colleagues. At the moment, you have a Minister for Health and Social Care that stands up and answers questions and doesn't always feel that they've got the answer and the information they need to be able to answer those questions correctly. And that this is why you need a minister that absolutely does have their foot on the pedal within Manx Care. We need to drive down costs. We need to make people feel that we have a healthcare that's that we can be proud of. And you've got to remember, Sir Jonathan Michael actually said that we should be the beacon where people follow, and we haven't achieved that. The next administration needs to get hold of that. But we, again, just to be fair to Manx Care, costs have increased. You know, everyday costs, prescriptions, everything, all of the general stuff. And this goes back to my question, with the question before about inflation and just the general increase in costs at the moment.
Now, while we're talking about Manx Care, we're going to have to address the topic of your brief time as Health Minister, because you described yourself in the previous manifesto once again as a politician who values openness, honesty and integrity. Yet, Tynwald did find that you had breached its standards and failed to act consistently with the principle of honesty. Now, why should voters trust your judgment today following that?
OK, I think you're absolutely right. So it's not just the sacking. I was sacked in October. It was a disagreement with the Chief Minister. I went into that department. I absolutely was very open to the Chief Minister and explained to him what a mess I'd seen. I did not get the support from the Chief Minister at the time. There was then obviously the Radson case going on about the appeal. That is all in the public domain. I felt I was very happy and very comfortable with independent legal advice. The Chief Minister wanted me to go in a different direction, which I wouldn't take. There's obviously this then gets embroiled into a debate, and the Chief Minister felt, you know, he had lost confidence in me within 7 weeks. That was extremely disappointing. There's nothing I can do. That's politics. What did hurt me personally was the three investigations that followed. And I don't think the public actually realised there was three investigations. It wasn't just the sacking. After I challenged statements made by the Chief Minister, so he had two investigations. And then Laurie Hooper, you know, made statements which, in my heart, I didn't believe was correct. Now, and those investigations had to go through, and it had a major impact on me personally, really did, seriously, because I am an open and honest, transparent MHK. What then happens is Tynwald did find me guilty, but to put this in context, my colleagues were not allowed to see any evidence. All they got was a final report, and they had to vote on a report. So they did not get to see the hundreds of pages of evidence. And even today, I would be very happy for that evidence to go in the public domain. Now, I could have done what happened to another member many years ago and refused to apologise, walk out of the chamber, and it just caused problem. Now, at this time, you have to remember it was best. I had to apologise or I'd have to be suspended. So it was easy for me just to stand up, make the apology. It was incredibly hurtful because I knew I was apologising for something that I did not agree with. And I know some of my colleagues did not agree with it. But you know something, Alex, I've come back stronger, I've come back better, and I'm a better politician today. But I would never allow my colleagues to do the same that happened to me. Because just to be absolutely fair, I've actually lobbied hard to make sure there's an appeals process, to make sure no politician on the Isle of Man ever goes through what I went through in 23. And I, you know, even today, I'd love all of the information to go in the public domain and for my constituents to judge me. But I think over time, I think my constituents still believe that I'm a very open, honest and transparent politician.
What do you feel is the biggest misconception that the public might have regarding what actually happened in regard to those investigations and the sacking?
I think if you look at it and look at the characters involved, I think the one person who's come out absolutely straight in all of this is me. You know, I've been very honest about this. Chief Minister and I had a disagreement over the ransom case. That's fine. That's politics. The allegations that Laurie Hooper made against me, you know, I was really hurtful by that and had a serious effect because he made so many. And I even today, I can't go into details of those. And if you talk about the one with the Chief Minister, it related to the signing of documents. And, you know, the Chief Minister found, you know, had to do another investigation. But let's be honest, I've come through this. I've rebuilt myself. And I'm grateful to the Chief Minister for giving me a chance. I took on the Chair of Planning, took on the Public Service, which is now responsible for looking after the civil service. And I've made sure that we've improved whistleblowing to make sure people can report openly and they will be looked after and they will be protected if they're making a genuine whistleblowing case in accordance with the policy. So I feel, overall, I've learned a very valuable lesson, but I'd never let anyone else go through it if I can help it.
Blunt question, do you feel the Chief Minister was right to dismiss you?
No, I don't think he was right. But the Chief Minister, you know, let's be honest, the Chief Minister doesn't have to explain himself. He had other people's view and there was four or five people who was giving him one set of information. I was on my own as the Minister. The Chief Minister had to make the decision. The question, you know, you could ask me, and I'll say it, you know, if I was in his shoes, what would I have done? I probably would have done the same because you had five people telling him one story. And you had one person. But just to be clear, me and the Chief Minister are very good friends. And as I say, I think over time, if you ask my colleagues now, today, I think a lot of them would vote differently, I promise you.
Final question on this matter, and it's back to the election, effectively. If a potential voter says to you, I like your policies, but I'm worried about your temperament, listening back to what they've heard about the report, what would you say to them?
I think most people, including my colleagues, would say I have a very good temperament. I've had to, in this job, you have to learn, you know, how to manage yourself. So yes, I have come, you know, when I came in 2016, I thought I could change the world. I did think I could, you know, argue strongly against officers. But in this job, you learn to balance. You know when to push, you know when to support. And I think even as Chair of Public Service Commission, even when I was in DfE, you know, I'm not afraid to get behind officers when I believe they're right and support them and actually make sure the public are aware of that. But if I think officers are wrong, I'm not afraid to challenge them. And I personally think I've got the balance right. So I'm not somebody who goes in like a bull in a china shop. I actually go in, I look at the evidence, I'll challenge the information. And from that, we're making the right decisions for the islands. And I'm proud of that because I've always done it since 2016.
In terms of accountability as an MHK and government accountability, some critics say that, you know, too many MHKs campaign as independents and you'll speak out on the radio and make speeches in the House on topics, but then vote with the government anyway once elected. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
No, I think if we're going to, let's be honest, we have the council ministers have a block vote, so they can guarantee 9 votes plus Treasury plus department. So you're talking about 9, 10, 11 votes even before they go into a debate. If you really want to influence policy, you need to roll up your sleeves and get into a department. So again, I was in DfE. I fought hard within the department to stop work permits disappearing altogether on the island. And I had a free vote in Tynwald to be able to put that because it was in my manifesto, so I had declared the position. So I think you need to work in departments to challenge the decisions because I think in this administration particularly, not enough MHKs have gone into departments. Too many things have been on the minister's shoulders. They then come through Tynwald and there have been poor decisions, work permit being one. And you have to fight the other way. We need MHKs that are not afraid to work in departments. Don't be afraid to work in departments. Don't be afraid to be Chair of Planning or the Public Service Commission or even Manx Utilities OFT. Roll up your sleeves, make sure the decisions coming out of those departments and out of those boards are sound and then stand behind them. And that is something that's gone missing this administration. You know, I've outlaid all my positions. I'm not afraid to do any of that work, but there's been too many MHKs who felt it's fine to sit on the back, throw stones and not actually contribute to changing the direction of this island.
In terms of the environment, back in 2021, you called for faster action on climate change, stronger interim targets. What's your feeling now on the environment, net zero and wind farms?
OK, let's go through all of these. So, yes, I think, again, let's look at the changing environment. back in 21, I think absolutely we had a climate emergency. Howard Quayle had made that decision. I think it was absolutely right that we do need to do more for our environment, protect our environment, our biosphere, our seabeds and everything else. But what actually, again, I go back to what happened. We had the Ukraine war, we had inflation, we had a cost of living crisis. So we have put schemes in place that has helped people, you know, shield their homes a bit better. But for me, let's go through them. Yes, I think we should keep going with the environmental, you know, objective of trying to reach net zero at some point. Can we achieve it by 2030? Unlikely. Can we achieve it by 2050? Possibly. But government's got to lead on this, and government's going to have to help people because some of the products are quite expensive.
But in terms of action over the last 5 years, we've only recently finally heard about getting some solar panels on public buildings. We've still not got any wind farms. And in terms of power generation from government, nothing seems to have happened.
Okay, well, I think you're absolutely right. We need to speed up, and this again will be in my manifesto. I think we need to cut some of the red tape from planning to make it happen. Government's got to lead on this. But I think there needs to be a massive conversation with Manx Utilities about what actually we put in place for the Isle of Man. You mentioned about the offshore wind farm. That is going to be highly controversial in this election.
And I'm going to push you. What's your opinion?
Okay, let me go through. So yep. If you go back to 2015, Ørsted actually had published... that was 2015, but they published originally, they published a report that gave two options. One option was to build the wind farm just off Laxey and then to pump all of the electricity to the UK. Absolutely firm no for me. That's absolutely clear as a day. I still have concerns about the location. I have concerns about the house. There is a second option, and the second option talks about connecting some of that wind farm into the Isle of Man through Gradle onto our grid, and it could produce enough electricity for 100,000 properties and businesses. It could significantly reduce electricity. Ørsted said it's going to be 10 or 15%. I think they're underestimating. I think it could be significantly higher. Now, as an MHK and as a person who lives on the island, a person who's going to be affected by this, I want to see that detail before I make a final decision on option two. And I think the public deserve a right to see that detail before we say no. And this has been so frustrating. This whole situation where we have lobby groups and we have people going through all the information, but the one person who's not given us the key information is government, Ørsted or Manx Utilities to tell us what is the benefits of option two. So option one, clear no. Option two, the public deserve to see that information and then make a sound decision based on that evidence.
A final quick question, because we're running short of time here. You did say that tourism recovery was a key priority and connectivity. The steam packet acquisition defended as a protecting a strategic lifeline. With the amount of money we've spent on it, has it delivered value for taxpayers?
I think it was the most important decision we had to make in 2018 to buy the steam packet, because if not, again, hindsight's a wonderful thing. People don't quite remember what could have happened. If we had not purchased the steam packet company in 2018, the company who had owned it would have ran it for cash pretty much until their contract ran out in 2026. And we would have been held ransom for several years. So it was absolutely right to purchase. Do I think we should have spent £80 million on one boat? No, we shouldn't. I think I need to go back and research this through the election, because myself personally, I thought we were going to get two boats for £80 million, not one boat for £70 million. I think the steam packet need to do more. So I would be very happy to see the steam packet pushed on yield. You know, there has to be a yield of 60, 70% every sailing. So they are forced to actually fill that boat to those levels. I want to see more transparency around the discounted tickets, because I don't think they're actually seeing it. I want to see a review of the costs. And if for example, things do get problematic in the autumn and the winter period, and we start to see again inflation rising, and we start to see hitting with utilities, and we start seeing difficulties with farmers because they can't get fertilizer and other crops, I would seriously consider the next, or ask the next administration to seriously consider capping the level of profit for the steam packet just during this period. But then we have to make sure that any profit that's, you know, given from the steam packet to businesses to support them and get them through it, that is then passed on to the customers who feel it in their pocket.
OK, Rob, and there's about 1 minute left. So with that time, what's your message to the voters in Onchan who are looking at your name on the ballot sheet?
Well, over the last 10 years, I've been visible, I've been hardworking, I've not been afraid to step forward and to work in government departments and to explain those difficult decisions to the people in Onchan. I have consistently been there for the people of Onchan. I still have so much drive and passion. I don't believe the last administration got everything right, and I wasn't always in the right place to make those changes. But if I can be in September, I will promise you I'll drive the changes through.
That was Rob Callister, who's hoping to retain his seat in Onchan. Also standing in the constituency are Gabriella Corkish, Julie Edge, Rachel Glover and Oliver Lockwood. This interview, along with all the others recorded as part of this series, will be available shortly after broadcast from your usual podcast provider. The general election is taking place on Thursday, the 24th of September, and as always, we have everything you need to know about it on our dedicated website, which you can find at manxradio.com.